The Golden Bough. A Study of Magic and Religion. By Sir James George Frazer. This audiobook was produced by Klaus-Dieter Mond, Rastatt, Germany and is published under the conditions of the Gutenberg Organization. Chapter 3. Sympathetic Magic. Section 2. Homeopathic or Imitative Magic. Part 4. Among the Chi-speaking peoples of the Gold Coast, the wives of men who are away with the army paint themselves white, and adorn their persons with beads and charms. On the day when a battle is expected to take place, they run about armed with guns, or sticks carved to look like guns, and taking green pawpaws, fruits shaped somewhat like a melon, they hack them with knives, as if they were chopping off the heads of the foe. The pantomime is no doubt merely an imitative charm, to enable the men to do to the enemy as the women do to the pawpaws. In the West African town of Framin, while the Ashanti War was raging some years ago, Mr. Fitzgerald Marriott saw a dance performed by women whose husbands had gone as carriers to the war. They were painted white and wore nothing but a short petticoat. At their head was a shriveled old sorceress in a very short white petticoat, her black hair arranged in a sort of long projecting horn, and her black face, breasts, arms, and legs profusely adorned with white circles and crescents. All carried long white brushes made of buffalo horse tails, and as they danced they sang, "Our husbands have gone to Ashanti land. May they sweep their enemies off the face of the earth." Among the Thompson Indians of British Columbia, when the men were on the war path, the women performed dances at frequent intervals. These dances were believed to ensure the success of the expedition. The dancers flourished their knives, threw long sharp-pointed sticks forward, or drew sticks with hooked ends repeatedly backward and forward. Throwing the sticks forward was symbolic of piercing or warding off the enemy, and drawing them back was symbolic of drawing their own men from danger. The hook at the end of the stick was particularly well adapted to serve the purpose of a life-saving apparatus. The women always pointed their weapons towards the enemy's country. They painted their faces red and sang as they danced, and they prayed to the weapons to preserve their husbands and help them to kill many foes. Some had eagle down stuck on the points of their sticks. When the dance was over, these weapons were hidden. If a woman whose husband was at the war thought she saw hair or a piece of a scalp on the weapon when she took it out, she knew that her husband had killed an enemy. But if she saw a stain of blood on it, she knew he was wounded or dead. When the men of the Yaqui tribe in California were away fighting, the women at home did not sleep. They danced continually in a circle, chanting and waving leafy wands. For they said that if they danced all the time, their husbands would not grow tired. Among the Haida Indians of the Queen Charlotte Islands, when the men had gone to war, the women at home would get up very early in the morning and pretend to make war by falling upon their children and feigning to take them for slaves. This was supposed to help their husbands to go and do likewise. If a wife were unfaithful to her husband while he was away on the warpath, he would probably be killed. For 10 nights all the women at home lay with their heads towards the point of the compass to which the war canoes had paddled away. Then they changed about, for the warriors were supposed to be coming home across the sea. At Masit the Haida women danced and sang war songs all the time their husbands were away at the wars, and they had to keep everything about them in a certain order. It was thought that a wife might kill her husband by not observing these customs. When a band of Carib Indians of the Orinoco had gone on the war path, their friends left in the village used to calculate as nearly as they could the exact moment when the absent warriors would be advancing to attack the enemy. Then they took 2 lads, laid them down on a bench, and inflicted a most severe scourging on their bare backs. This the youths submitted to without a murmur, supported in their sufferings by the firm conviction, in which they had been bred from childhood, that on the constancy and fortitude with which they bore the cruel ordeal depended the valor and success of their comrades in the battle. Among the many beneficent uses to which a mistaken ingenuity has applied the principle of homeopathic or imitative magic, is that of causing trees and plants to bear fruit in due season. In Thuringia, the man who sows flax carries the seed in a long bag which reaches from his shoulders to his knees, and he walks with long strides, so that the bag sways to and fro on his back. It is believed that this will cause the flax to wave in the wind. In the interior of Sumatra, rice is sown by women who, in sowing, let their hair hang loose down their back, in order that the rice may grow luxuriantly and have long stalks. Similarly, in ancient Mexico, a festival was held in honor of the goddess of maize, or the long-haired mother, as she was called. It began at the time when the plant had attained its full growth, and fibers shooting forth from the top of the green ear indicated that the grain was fully formed. During this festival, the women wore their long hair and bound, shaking and tossing it in the dances which were the chief feature in the ceremonial, in order that the tassel of the maize might grow in like profusion, that the grain might be correspondingly large and flat, and that the people might have abundance. In many parts of Europe, dancing or leaping high in the air are approved homeopathic modes of making the crops grow high. Thus in Franche-Comté they say that you should dance at the carnival in order to make the hemp grow tall. The notion that a person can influence a plant homeopathically by his act or condition comes out clearly in a remark made by a Malay woman. Being asked why she stripped the upper part of her body naked in reaping the rice, she explained that she did it to make the rice husks thinner, as she was tired of pounding thick husked rice. Clearly, she thought that the less clothing she wore, the less husk there would be on the rice. The magic virtue of a pregnant woman to communicate fertility is known to Bavarian and Austrian peasants, who think that if you give the first fruit of a tree to a woman with child to eat, the tree will bring forth abundantly next year. On the other hand, the Baganda believe that a barren wife infects her husband's garden with her own sterility and prevents the trees from bearing fruit. Hence a childless woman is generally divorced. The Greeks and Romans sacrificed pregnant victims to the goddesses of the corn and of the earth, doubtless in order that the earth might teem and the corn swell in the ear. When a Catholic priest remonstrated with the Indians of the Orinoco on allowing their women to sow the fields in the blazing sun, with infants at their breasts, the men answered, "Father, you don't understand these things, and that is why they vex you. You know that women are accustomed to bear children, and that we men are not. When the women sow, the stalk of the maize bears 2 or 3 ears, the root of the yucca yields 2 or 3 basketfuls, and everything multiplies in proportion. Now why is that? Simply because the women know how to bring forth, and know how to make the seed which they sow bring forth also. Let them sow, then. We men don't know as much about it as they do." Thus on the theory of homeopathic magic, a person can influence vegetation either for good or for evil according to the good or the bad character of his acts or states. For example, a fruitful woman makes plants fruitful, a barren woman makes them barren. Hence this belief in the noxious and infectious nature of certain personal qualities or accidents has given rise to a number of prohibitions or rules of avoidance. People abstain from doing certain things lest they should homeopathically infect the fruits of the earth with their own undesirable state or condition. All such customs of abstention or rules of avoidance are examples of negative magic or taboo. Thus, for example, arguing from what may be called the infectiousness of personal acts or states, the Galelaris say that you ought not to shoot with a bow and arrows under a fruit tree, or the tree will cast its fruit even as the arrows fall to the ground. And that when you are eating watermelon, you ought not to mix the pips which you spit out of your mouth with the pips which you have put aside to serve as seed. For if you do, though the pips you spat out may certainly spring up and blossom, yet the blossoms will keep falling off just as the pips fell from your mouth, and thus these pips will never bear fruit. Precisely the same train of thought leads the Bavarian peasant to believe that if he allows the graft of a fruit tree to fall on the ground, the tree that springs from that graft will let its fruit fall untimely. When the Chams of Cochinchina are sowing their dry rice fields and desire that no shower should fall, they eat their rice dry in order to prevent rain from spoiling the crop. In the foregoing cases, a person is supposed to influence vegetation homeopathically. He infects trees or plants with qualities or accidents, good or bad, resembling them derived from his own. But on the principle of homeopathic magic, the influence is mutual. The plant can infect the man just as much as the man can infect the plant. In magic, as I believe in physics, action and reaction are equal and opposite. The Cherokee Indians are adepts in practical botany of the homeopathic sort. Thus weary roots of the catgut plant are so tough that they can almost stop a plowshare in the furrow. Hence Cherokee women wash their heads with a decoction of the roots to make their hair strong, and Cherokee ball players wash themselves with it to toughen their muscles. It is a Galelaris belief that if you eat a fruit which has fallen to the ground, you will yourself contract a disposition to stumble and fall. And that if you partake of something which has been forgotten, such as a sweet potato left in the pot or a banana in the fire, you will become forgetful. The Galelaris are also of opinion that if a woman were to consume two bananas growing from a single head, she would give birth to twins. The Guarani Indians of South America thought that a woman would become a mother of twins if she ate a double grain of millet. In Vedic times, a curious application of this principle supplied a charm by which a banished prince might be restored to his kingdom. He had to eat food cooked on a fire which was fed with wood which had grown out of the stump of a tree which had been cut down. The recuperative power manifested by such a tree would in due course be communicated through the fire to the food, and so to the prince, who ate the food which was cooked on the fire which was fed with the wood which grew out of the tree. The Sudanese think that if a house is built of the wood of thorny trees, the life of the people who dwell in that house will likewise be thorny and full of trouble. There is a fruitful branch of homeopathic magic which works by means of the dead. For just as the dead can neither see nor hear nor speak, so you may on homeopathic principles render people blind, deaf and dumb by the use of dead men's bones or anything else that is tainted by the infection of death. Thus among the Galelaris, when a young man goes a-wooing at night, he takes a little earth from a grave and strews it on the roof of his sweetheart's house just above the place where her parents sleep. This, he fancies, will prevent them from waking while he converses with his beloved, since the earth from the grave will make them sleep as sound as the dead. Burglars in all ages and many lands have been patrons of this species of magic, which is very useful to them in the exercise of their profession. Thus a South Slavonian housebreaker sometimes begins operations by throwing a dead man's bone over the house, saying, with pungent sarcasm, "As this bone may waken, so may these people waken." After that, not a soul in the house can keep his or her eyes open. Similarly, in Java the burglar takes earth from a grave and sprinkles it round the house which he intends to rob. This throws the inmates into a deep sleep. With the same intention, a Hindu will strew ashes from a pyre at the door of the house. Indians of Peru scatter the dust of dead men's bones. And Ruthenian burglars remove the marrow from a human shin bone, pour a tallow into it, and having kindled the tallow, march thrice round the house with this candle burning, which causes the inmates to sleep a death-like sleep. Or the Ruthenian will make a flute out of a human leg bone and play upon it. Whereupon all persons within hearing are overcome with drowsiness. The Indians of Mexico employed for this maleficent purpose a left forearm of a woman who had died in giving birth to her first child. But the arm had to be stolen. With it they beat the ground before they entered the house which they designed to plunder. This caused everyone in the house to lose all power of speech and motion. They were as dead, hearing and seeing everything, but perfectly powerless. Some of them, however, really slept and even snored. In Europe, similar properties were ascribed to the hand of glory, which was the dried and pickled hand of a man who had been hanged. If a candle made of the fat of a malefactor who had also died on the gallows was lighted and placed in the hand of glory as in a candlestick, it rendered motionless all the persons to whom it was presented. They could not stir a finger any more than if they were dead. Sometimes the dead man's hand is itself the candle, or rather bunch of candles, all its withered fingers being set on fire. But should any member of the household be awake, one of the fingers will not kindle. Such nefarious lights can only be extinguished with milk. Often it is prescribed that the thief's candle should be made of the finger of a newborn or, still better, unborn child. Sometimes it is thought needful that the thief should have one such candle for every person in the house, for if he has one candle too little, somebody in the house will wake and catch him. Once these tapers begin to burn, there is nothing but milk that will put them out. In the 17th century, robbers used to murder pregnant women in order thus to extract candles from their wombs. An ancient Greek robber or burglar thought he could silence and put to flight the fiercest watchdogs by carrying with him a brand plucked from a funeral pyre. Again, Serbian and Bulgarian women who chafe at the restraints of domestic life will take the copper coins from the eyes of a corpse, wash them in wine or water, and give the liquid to their husband to drink. After swallowing it, the husband will be as blind to his wife's peccadilloes as the dead man was on whose eyes the coins were laid.